Good morning. I'm Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, philosopher kings from Queens. This is Morning Sedition. Mark Maron is away all week getting a much-needed rest. Good morning to all our bakers on the West Coast who are listening to us. Good morning to all our long-distance truckers. Good morning, Dallas, Texas. We are now on 910 AM WXEB live from 5 to 8 a.m. Central Time. Good morning to Little Kim. You're going to look good in orange. Good morning to Paul Wolfowitz. More on that later. But let us welcome to our microphones a superstar, a man who's been known as Dude Love, a man who's been known as Mankind, a man who's been known as Cactus Jack, a man who's been known as a best-selling author. His name is Mr. Mick Foley. Good morning, Mick.
Ah, thank you. Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here. And I'm wondering...
there we go.
As you give me that wonderful introduction, I'm wondering, have I been here enough to where I'm actually accepted as a reasonable... fill in for Mark Maron, or there's still people out listening going, wrestler, on?
Hey, wake up. He's a wrestler. He's got opinions. He's got attitude. He's got the facts.
Yeah, I came out during this presidential election, one of the very rare progressive wrestlers, or at least one of the very rare ones willing to go on the record as being progressive, yeah. Because I felt at the time that our company was being overrepresented on the conservative side, that there were a bunch of people making their opinions loudly known in support for President Bush. And my feeling was that, wrestling fans are a diverse group, that there are some on the left, there's some on the right, and probably most of them are in the center.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like the center or the left opinions were being spoken for, so I decided to come out and speak for them. And I had this fear, Mark, that I was going to wake up on November 3rd and find out that John Kerry had lost by like 17 votes.
Oh, wow.
And that I would be like the guy in Schindler's List thinking, I could have done more. I could have done more.
Now, you did plenty.
Had I known he was going to lose by several million, I may have kept my mouth shut. But by that point, it was too late. I would already gone on record in support of a lot of the progressive agenda. And so now we're gearing up for 2006. It's going to be a big midterm, and I'm going to try to speak up for those people who I feel are voting against their better interests.
Yeah, speak up for people who work for a living, as opposed to those who simply live off their investments. Not there's anything wrong with investments, mind you, but I don't know. Every now and then I get a feeling that this administration really cherishes the investor group in America at the expense of people who work for a salary every day.
Well, speaking of working people, I read a statistic that was kind of pretty sobering to me. It said something along the lines of that among the white working class male, President Bush, they voted for President Bush by 20-point margin.
Yeah.
I thought, man, is that disturbing? Because now you have a president who can pretty much take that vote for granted. And I think that the better things go on the March for Freedom, mm-hmm. Freedom on the March agenda, that the more he can take them for granted. And it's sad, and I'm hoping that maybe that's where I can come in, as a guy who hopefully connects with working class white males.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, Mick. We've seen, and later on this morning, we're going to talk about some stuff that just went on overnight, where President Bush got directly involved in the case of Terri Schiavo, the young lady in Florida, who is, I guess, got her feeding tube back in, or very close to it.
And I think one of the strange things is that he seems to be directly contradicting a judgment he made when he was the governor of Texas, and
yeah.
I'm sure we'll get into that.
And later this morning, too, we're going to be talking to Bruce Weber. No, not the coach of the Illinois University basketball team, Bruce Weber from the New York Times, who did a piece that I know was of interest to you, Mick, about Harley Race's wrestling school out in Missouri.
Sure. Harley Race is a very good friend of mine. I'll actually be working for Harley.
Really?
April 1st, but it's Harley is so respected in the business that guys like me actually volunteer to be on his shows, for free.
Really?
Yeah. So I was going to be in Louisiana on the 30th of March and Green Bay on the 2nd of April, and I thought instead of flying all the way back to New York, getting on a plane first thing in the morning going to Green Bay that I would just stop off in Kansas City and do Harley shows. So that's how highly people in our industry think of Harley. And I thought the guy did a great job. I thought it was a very positive article. I had, had an issue with a couple of things he said, and maybe I'll bring that up.
Yeah, you're going to have to bring it up, Faith.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure he's not going to disagree with me too loudly. How about that?
Well, I especially just keep this in mind. I disagreed with his statements that he made, not in the article, but in another interview, about the red-blue state divide when it comes to wrestling fans.
Yeah. Now, later this morning, we're also going to be talking with David Korn. David Korn, of course, is from The Nation magazine. He's going to be calling us from Maryland. He's going to be talking about Paul Wolfowitz, and this is something that you have some personal experience. Later this morning, folks, there's going to be Mick Foley's My Dinner with Wolf.
Now, we talked about this a little bit when you were on vacation. I didn't know when I got the esteemed fill-in role at the end of December that I was actually asked to fill in during the week that nobody listened to radio. People were not actually up at 6 in the morning getting their dose of Marin and Riley. So it is conceivable there's an awful lot of people out there who have no idea about My Dinner with Wolfie, so we may go over that in some detail.
Yeah, because that's fascinating. I was out of the country at the time. I was in England, so I didn't get a chance to hear it. So I want to hear about Your Dinner with Wolfie. Plus, we got a bomb to drop about the guy as well. This is the guy that everyone thinks is going to be taking over the World Bank. Some people may not be so sure by the time you finish listening to us this morning.
And I helped uncover a little bit of this,
yes,
right?
You
I
did.
Was if I sound a little bit groggy, it's not just because I've been hit many times over the head with chairs, it's because I flew in from England last night. I got in about 10 at night and then had to be up very early. And while you guys were in the boardroom talking about Wolfowitz, I said, "Do you hear anything about Wolfowitz and his affair, maybe providing a contradiction or maybe
a problem, maybe.
A problem, yeah. Not a contradiction, a problem.
Yeah.
And as far
alleged
as...
Alleged affair. Neither have confirmed or denied.
And so I said, well, I was reading the... I asked if I could read The Guardian, only because The Guardian did a really good review on my last book. So I only try to support the papers that give me good book reviews.
There you go.
And instead they handed me the Daily Mail, and it's a little bit of a tabloid. But I did come across this headline that said, "Will a British divorcee cost Wolfie," that's my name for him too, "Wolfie his job?" And so we'll look into that.
Yeah, we're going to look into that. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Social Security, whether those add-on investments are dead in the water. And Bush is turning on the charm, Mick. Trying to get this Social Security thing done.
You know what? I have a theory on this. I think he realizes that if he plugs away and plugs away and plugs away and says the same thing over and over, it may have the Jenny on the block effect.
Hold that thought. We got to take a break. We got to come back to that thought, though. Mick Foley is here with us. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Are you...
Good morning. This is Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation this week. Our guest, co-host in studio, the legendary Mick Foley. Good morning, Mick.
That was my own sound effect.
Wait a minute. I think I may have one here for you. Wait a minute. Let me see if this works.
That's more of an Al Snow type of response. I generally got better responses than that.
Yeah, you certainly did. Now, Mick, we're going to talk a little Social Security.
Yes.
And as a person who is, dare I say, getting up in years, this whole battle is starting to really interest me
deal. Oh, okay, you're referring to yourself.
Yes, all I'm right. referring only to myself. You look forever. You don't look any different than you did when you started wrestling back in the day.
You know what? I need to get my passport renewed here in about a month, and I pretty much look exactly the same as I did 10 years ago.
Well, that's because you've been to so many countries, your passport has run out of places to stamp, for goodness sake. We'll get into that a little bit later. You know, it looks like the Bush administration, in addition to, marshaling the troops, trying to news, doing all of these different things to promote Social Security, using the auspices of these different 527 organizations like Compass, what they're doing is apparently trying to charm some of the more recalcitrant Republican members of Congress. They've been bringing them in for meetings with Dick Cheney and with other administration people, trying to get them on board with the president's Social Security plan. But part of the problem here, Mick, is I think that people are really confused about what's contained in the plan other than the private accounts.
Well, I think what Bush is doing here, he's going on tour for 60 days,
yeah.
Right? Now, I referred to my Jenny on the block theory, which, as I thought about it during the commercial break, is a terrible analogy, but I'm going to give it to you.
Go ahead, give it to
anyway, you know, we know that this administration is really good at creating their own news. And I'm not just talking about the prepackaged news segments that have been talked about. But by not giving the press much to bite on, their sound bites become the only available news from the administration.
Yeah.
And so by going on the road for 60 days, it's almost as if it's a subtle form of brainwashing that the American public will hear the same message over and over and over. And that message, which may seem to be dangerous now and seemed dangerous 30 days ago, may seem to start making sense 60 days from now. And I'm thinking about Jenny on the Block, where my kids and I have a divide when it comes to music.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a traditional classic rock and roll and okay. country music guy. I listen to a little Irish here, a little classical there, and I can't stand what passes for popular music these days.
Uh-oh.
And when Jenny on the Block would come on, I would say, how can you kids listen to this stuff? But after about 90 days of being bombarded, I'm finding myself in the car by myself without the kids even being in there going, don't be fooled by the rocks that I've got. I'm still Jenny. Like, if you hit somebody with something over and over and over, eventually it will come to sound good to them.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that that is what this whole idea of an ownership society will end up doing. To a lot of America, they'll say, hey, if I keep hearing it over and over, it must be good for me. I'm gonna have a stake in an ownership society. And it's worrisome to me because I think people and the public will start warming up to it.
Well, right now, they're not warming up too much. According to the latest Newsweek poll, 33% of respondents approve of the president's handling of Social Security. 59% disapprove. He lags far behind his Democratic opponents in Congress when it comes to the question of trust on Social Security. 33% trust Bush, 44% trust Democrats, but that's not those aren't numbers I think the Democrats can afford to rest on their laurels on.
But
neither.
The president has not yet begun to plug.
No, he really hasn't. And this charm offensive that we're talking about is part of the game. They're bringing in these people. They're bringing into a very comfortable, calm setting. They're having these administration figures like Dick Cheney sit and chat with them in a very informal, you know, kind of setting where they're being treated as very special members of Congress. And remember that according to one of these articles that I have in front of me, that Bush has kind of treated individual members of Congress like the shock troops who are supposed to go out and pursue his agenda, period, and not really get personally involved. This shows a level of personal involvement to try and get them all on the same page to move forward.
Because he realizes that they don't have to vote strictly according to party lines, that a lot of these guys, Republicans, represent areas where people are hard hit, and I think they're afraid that if they go out in support of this plan, that they may find their midterms not to their liking.
Yeah, that is a great fear among both Democrats and Republicans. Democrats have shown an incredible amount of unity in lining up against this proposal in both the House and the Senate. Charles Rangel in the House says if the private accounts thing is part of any Social Security plan, Democrats will not back it, period. When it comes to the Senate, most Democratic senators are saying, again, personal accounts, no way this legislation passes. Now, the flip side of that is that Bush has kept his plans vague and has simultaneously invited people to come
sure.
in and say, well, we cherish your ideas. What do you think ought to be done? We know there's a problem. And see, I think that's the first part of the building blocks. They want to establish that there's a problem. And it looks like, according to some polling numbers, they've established in the minds of many people that there is a problem with Social Security. Now, the question is how best to fix it. And when you don't have a plan, you have the advantage of being able to say, well, these people are just taking shots at something they know nothing about because I haven't issued anything yet.
Now, wouldn't the correct stance, especially if you're supposed to be fiscally conservative, to be say, at least put it in the minds of the American people, all right, we've got a problem. Now is not the time to address it because we have to do something about this deficit.
Yeah.
But I ask the person who comes in, my replacement, the next president, to keep that at the top of his agenda because sooner or later we're going to have to face this. But to face it now with so many other things on our plate. I think Senator Kennedy had a list of 26 issues that he considered to be actual crises.
Yeah.
And Social Security was not among them. When I came on the first time, I was talking about poverty in this country. And, man, you never hear poverty spoken about, you know. And it looks...
But you can see it.
You can see it, and it's growing. I don't even want to see the statistics now, because it was at 30 million people in the land of plenty living below the poverty line. And it's almost like from Clinton to the Bush administration, you're looking at a readout on a stair stepper.
Yeah.
Poverty going down, 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 down during the Clinton years, going up, up, up during the Bush years. But as long as, and I kind of referred to this earlier, as long as the president is perceived as having successes overseas, it kind of alleviates any pressure on him to take care of the problems that the working class and that the lower classes have right now. And as long as he knows that working class is going to vote his way, and as long as he knows that a lot of people in the lower classes, and I don't mean that, not in a disparaging way. I'm just talking about people who have a very, very difficult time making it in this country. As long as he knows that they are probably not going to vote, or they might vote against their interests, he doesn't have to address that issue.
No, he doesn't. And it's fascinating to see these thousand little paper cuts that working people have to endure: an increase in the bridges and tunnels, an increase in electricity costs, an increase at the gasoline pump. All these little increases that people don't always put together and say, you know what, you're taking more and more money out of the pockets of people that really can't afford it. And, of course, in Congress, they all argue, well, you know, we're going to find a way to exempt the poorest people in the country. But they never quite do. They never manage to make sure that people aren't having to make the choice between buying enough food to feed their family for a week or getting back and forth to work for a week or making sure that their kids are able to get a new pair of shoes or a new backpack or something that they may need to go to school so that they don't feel like they're going and broken. And you know, I know how it feels to go someplace with holes in your shoes and that sort of thing. And, you know, again, no one's saying you need $1 zillion to fix a lot of these problems. But right now, as you very correctly point out, Mick, those problems are being completely ignored.
Well, during the break, you and I were talking about the theory of social Darwinism.
Yeah.
And whether or not it's just, hey, you fend for yourself. This
survival
is an ownership society.
Place.
You're getting your chance. If you don't make the most of it, hey, it's not our fault.
We're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit more about this. We're also going to get into Terry Schiavo in the next half hour to deal with that situation again, which is fluid. It's been happening as we speak. Stay with us. Mick Foley is our special guest co-host here on Mornings Edition, Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Hi.
Good morning. This is Morning's Edition. And, of course, you're listening to Air America Radio. My name's Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. Don't worry. He'll be back. Don't worry. Don't get panicked. Our special guest co-host, wrestling legend Mick Foley. You know, we usually, at this time, Mick, get Ramon to come in and drop off the Palm Pilot of the day. But Ramon apparently went on vacation with Maron. He's out on the West Coast someplace, or he's out in the ether somewhere. But you know what? We still have a Palm Pilot for this morning, courtesy of our returning Kent, the Colonel Jones.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you today?
Good morning.
Right on.
Okay, can I just interject some just for a second? You know, when I don't mean to sound so disappointed. I don't mean to break up the show, but I was hoping when you guys asked me to co-host, I was like, does that mean I get to read the Palm Pilot? And apparently I've got my answer. So go ahead with the break one man's dream here and read your Palm Pilot.
You're a little bit there. All right, here we go. Secretary of State Condi Rice is still on her goodwill trip to Asia, and now we have her Palm Pilot. 6 a.m., wake up in China. Hello.
Oh, that's funny.
A nation more than 1 billion people, but my bed is empty.
Oh.
7 a.m. Martial arts training session with Shaolin monks. Learn to kill silently with one finger. Pluck the eye from the sleeping dragon.
All right, that one's good. That's good.
You like that? We'll keep going. 10 a.m. Meet with officials. discuss repressive, secretive regime and the casual disregard for human rights. Then talk about China.
Oh. All right. You're winning me over, Colonel. You're winning me over.
I'm working hard here. 12:30 p.m. Proposed toast. Quote, for your friendship, the United States is forever in your debt. Note, given the amount of American debt China has bought, we actually are forever in their debt. 2 p.m. Economic meeting. Tell them it is a positive factor that the Chinese economy is growing, which is code for go ahead and invade Taiwan. We don't have enough troops to stop you. 4 p.m. Call President Bush. Assure him that the sucking up is going well and that the Chinese won't exterminate us from the planet for at least another 6 months or so.
Ooh.
Mm. 9 p.m. Candlelit dinner. Spring rolls. Mushu vegetables. Plum wine. Alone.
Ooh.
Always alone. So alone.
Ooh.
And that's that, with apologies to Mick Fox.
Welcome back, Colonel.
Thank you very much. Good to be back.
That was well done.
It was well done. You didn't laugh much, Mick.
I was smirking.
Oh,
it was a silent, silent smirk.
Sure.
Very, yeah.
Sure wasn't this.
Oh, sad.
Well, you know, I couldn't laugh because we kept going to the theme of Condi being alone, and I hadn't thought of it. She is lonely. And when the president was announcing her as the nominee, you could see her just, like, gazing at him. And so I read an article. It was like a cheerleader with a crush on the football player, knowing it will never quite be responded to.
Wow.
But she'll never.
This is deep.
I think she, you know, is there any Condi man on record?
Not that I know of. I don't keep up with that. But
she used to date Gene Washington, who's head of the NFL players.
Really?
Yeah, she used to date him.
She's a huge Redskins fan, right?
Yeah, she's a huge football fan. She apparently, as a kid, she used to watch with her father all the time. And I'm sure she's got an iPod with 5 zillion classical music pieces in it.
Think she's into the pro wrestling thing?
Well, I don't know, man.
Maybe I could.
You're
watch
not auditioning for.
No, but you know, if she is lonely, maybe I could show up, watch a little WrestleMania on Condi's couch, try to talk some progressive issues with her.
That might work for about 30 seconds. Man, Mick, I don't know what Congress has been up to over this past weekend. It has been scary. I know many people in our listening audience have been following the case of Terri Schiavo, this lady who has been virtually comatose. For some time now, at 1:11 a.m. this morning, our president signed a bill into law that requires that the federal court now take up the issue of whether or not Terri Schiavo's feeding tube should be removed.
And this is a man who campaigned on states' rights.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes, he did campaign on states' rights, and many people in the House of Representatives and the Senate also championed, allegedly, states' rights. Tom DeLay. An example of a guy who's from Texas. He thinks Texas is a separate country anyway.
I was shocked. When I came in from England, I turned on CNN. It was about 10:30, and I saw they were going to have this vote after midnight. How many times in the history of Congress have they had votes after midnight?
They have very rarely, except if it's been on you know, an issue that's been discussed over and over and over again over the long run. What they had to do here was extraordinary. They had to get a quorum, which is 218 members of the House, after the House had adjourned for a recess on Friday.
Yeah, that's. I asked you earlier why so few members of Congress. You told me they were on recess.
They were
calling
them
in for this. Emergency vote. It's disturbing to me. I mean, I can understand where there's room for discussion, argument. I can sympathize with both sides, but to have a federal court make the decision seems to be contrary to what Republicans used to stand for.
Yeah. Now, this vote actually throws the case to a federal court where a federal court might be able to rule. They haven't done this yet, but a federal court might rule that the feeding tube could be reinserted. This is essentially an end around several court decisions that have forced the removal of the tube.
Now, all of this could have been avoided if the young woman had a will or a plan, right?
Yeah, if there had been a will or a living will. Now, Terri Schiavo actually had a serious heart attack, heart failure, back in 1990.
Okay.
And this case is a mess because it has engendered passions on all sides. What has happened is her family, the Schindler family, is fighting her husband, Michael Schiavo. And the problem with Schiavo is, of course, he's moved on. He's got a woman that he lives with, that he's had two children with, and that has played into all of this. Also, Republican partisan politics
sure.
has played into all this. Tom DeLay led the effort to get Congress to act on this. The president, a Republican, signed it into law, and there was even a memo that said this was a perfect political issue for the Republican Party.
And I wish, if you're out there, people listening, I mean, I don't understand why people are afraid to make out wills. It's in some way they don't want to believe in their own mortality.
That is it.
Not only is it important, but I did it 2 years ago. It's actually fun to control, your decisions and even your money from the grave. To me, it wasn't cryptic. It was kind of exciting to decide who gets what.
Yeah.
And I know, in my case, I did not opt for heroic measures. But when there's nothing written, and from what I understand, even a piece of notebook paper with her intentions on it would have sufficed, but there wasn't even that. So now you've just got the word of a husband who, as you said, has gone on to have children with another woman against the parents. My gut feeling is, you have to listen to the parents. But, again, I don't think that's for the federal court to decide.
Yeah. Now, Tom DeLay calls this a Palm Sunday compromise, which isn't exactly accurate since the vote took place at 12:42 a.m. this morning. But bottom line, you have seen the Congress now. In several instances, act in a very activist manner, and in this case, to deal with the actions of a court, specifically a state court. And you've seen, for example, the Government Reform Committee in an extraordinary session on Friday try and get the courts to act to countermand the Florida ruling. The Supreme Court slapped that one down. I mean, this is just an incredible case in terms of the number of permutations. And it's interesting to me, as you pointed out, Mick, that on the one hand, Congress seems very willing to abrogate states' rights in this regard. But beyond that, what else will they end up doing that will indicate that they are prepared to rule where the courts are not in sync with them? Because that's what we have here.
Well, I think they see the benefits long term for I think everything at this point points to the midterms. And there's even a GOP memo. This is coming from the Washington Post, saying the issue offers political rewards.
Yeah.
And if I can read from it just a second, it said Republican leaders believe their attention to the Terry Schiavo issue could pay dividends with Christian conservatives whose support they covet in 2006 midterm elections, according to a GOP memo intended to be seen only by senators. That's a shame that they're basically playing around with this woman's life.
Yeah, they are. And to his credit, Bill Frist in the Senate has condemned that particular memo. But the fact of the matter is, it's true. Republicans are, in fact, trying to use this to their advantage. But when we come back after this break, we're going to tell you about a couple of Texas cases that Congress did absolutely nothing about. Mick Foley is our special guest co-host. My name is Mark Riley. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Are you?
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio, 48 minutes past the hour. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. Our special guest co-host, wrestling superstar Mick Foley. We're talking about the Terry Schiavo case and a couple of related cases, Mick, coming out of the state of Texas, George W. Bush's home state, that involved him directly and involved the right to die directly.
The president apparently, did sign into law something that states that the family does have a right, I believe, to take their loved one off of life support.
The hospital
has a right based on two things, right? One is inability to pay.
Yes.
Which does, I do have an argument with that, especially in the case of this young woman who had to take whose son was taken off life support. Basically, she couldn't afford to keep him alive.
Alive.
So there's an issue there.
That was son Hudson, who was 6 months old, and who was disconnected from life support last Tuesday at 2 o'clock local time. Now, the Bush administration, the Congress, the rest of these folks did not jump in on this six-month-old child's behalf. And essentially Texas Children's Hospital essentially said, look, they can't pay, and we don't think he's going to get any better. He apparently suffered from a very unique form of dwarfism that was characterized by short arms, short legs, and lungs that were too tiny, I guess, to take in air. Most people who are born with this die very shortly, but this young man was still alive. His mother and his mother's description of how he was very different than the hospital's description. But yet the hospital, after the mother tried to keep her own son alive, the hospital finally decided to discontinue care. And after breathing a couple of times on his own, the child died.
And if that woman had been had the financial means, that child would still be hooked up to life support.
Yes. Now, on another case is coming out of Texas, and it's interesting because these two cases have in common a really, really driven attorney by the name of Mario Caballero, who actually argued on behalf of the patients in both of these cases. In a second incident, there's a man whose last name is Nicolozos. And he was in a similar situation, 68 years old. They wanted to take him off life support. Mario Caballero finally fought long enough to the point that a place called Avalon Place decided to take him in after initially rejecting him. Spiro Nicolozos is still on life support, still alive,
okay.
Where had he stayed in the hospital, he might well not be with us. This is St. Luke's Hospital, and actually St. Luke's Episcopal Hospital in San Antonio, Texas. How ironic that George W. Bush, as you point out, signed into law the measures that allow people to end life on this instance, but at 1:12 this morning, he signed into law something very different in the Schiavo case. I don't know how you reconcile
that. I think the reason seems to be because there's videotape on Terry Schiavo,
yeah.
That's another mystery to me because in my own case, like I said, I wouldn't want to be kept alive by heroic measures, but maybe I should have something written into my will that if I am kept alive by heroic measures, keep the video camera away
from
my bed.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen pictures of Terry Schiavo when she was younger, she was a beautiful young lady.
Yeah.
It's startling how much her facial features have changed over the course of the time she spent in under care. It's just tragic to me. To me, I see that video. I don't see how I see the video, and my heart goes out to her. And my feeling is that nobody should be kept alive and have a circus made out of their life. Not that I have anything against circuses. I was just at Ringling Brothers. That's probably a terrible comparison to make. But you know, it seems to be making a mockery out of her life. I guess some people see her as a major player and a saint almost in the pro-life movement.
Yeah.
But I don't think that does much to influence people's pro-life positions. I think if anything, it would make them empathize with the other side.
I would think so. And I'll tell you, Mick, I was when I first heard that they withdrew her feeding tube. My initial impression was that she was going to die immediately.
Yeah.
But then apparently it's going to take like 2 weeks, at least, according to some medical experts, for her to pass away. And I wonder whether people don't react emotionally to the idea that this woman is slowly going to dehydrate to death. And that maybe is part of the reason why some people that maybe have principles as opposed to people who want to use this for partisan political purpose, may side with the family that wants to keep her alive.
Yeah, I think we have a couple of sound bites from the congressmen or senators.
There are a lot of folks who have gone back and forth on the Terry Schiavo case. And, of course, they were debating this on the House floor in the middle of the night last night. Barney Frank, our good friend from Massachusetts, had a very good analogy as far as what the House is doing. Let's hear from Barney Frank.
We're not doctors. We just play them on C-SPAN.
Amen. Okay. I mean, this is like you do have, to some extent, the Congress of the United States, you know, determining who's going to live and who's going to die. Why is Son Hudson's case not worthy of their concern? Why aren't they debating that issue? Or why aren't they debating the issue of Spiro Nicolosos? Why aren't they talking about these issues? Why Terry Schiavo? And I think, Mick, you hit on it because there's videotape, because that one was the one that got out in the news. And I guess maybe they figure the inherent contradictions in their conduct here and what's going on in Texas might not get revealed. But, of course, that's why we're here.
Sure. If that was, if they were publicizing the Texas case, it would make the president look foolish. And,
yeah.
We certainly wouldn't want that to happen.
Oh, no, never that. But, I mean, it's incredible to see the logic that some of these folks are using. You know, Tom DeLay, Mark Maron has a whole thing about him being a dwarf king, exterminating so-and-so. You know, he was the one that really kind of marshaled the forces together. He got Denny Hastert, the Speaker of the House, to get all of these people back into Washington. That was no small feat. And George W. Bush, I don't know where he was, but he popped back into D.C. just in time to sign this legislation. They still have no guarantees. They may get it to a federal court, and a federal judge may say, you know what, I think the state was right in this particular instance. But it is instructive, Mick, that neither the Florida legislature nor the president's own brother, Jeb Bush, would get directly involved on this level.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They didn't get involved. They didn't introduce a bill. There's a problem here that I think people need to take a very long and serious look at. Why, on the state level, well, you have Republicans in control, both of, you know, the Florida legislature and the governor's mansion. Why, how come, you know, they may have expressed concern, but that concern did not take the shape of legislation. We see this Congress, the 109th Congress, getting involved on an activist level. That is a slippery, slippery slope. Where are they going to rear their ugly heads next? You know, the same committee, I find it truly ironic, the same committee, the Government Reform Committee, that dealt with the steroids issue also dealt with the Shivo issue. That's fascinating to me.
I think it all goes back to the midterms. I think these people want a high-profile case that they can bring to their constituents and say, hey, look what I did. Look what I did for pro-life. I heard one congresswoman, again, it was late when I got in. I wish I had taken down her name. She was a Republican congresswoman who actually used the term murder and really emphasized the word.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, I mean, there is a very gray area here in this case, but nowhere does the word murder fit into it.
No, murder does not fit into it. It is an emotional case. It's a case where people really do have to kind of check their own feelings about the right to die, their own feelings about adultery, for that matter.
Sure.
You know, the whole idea that this is a case that has generated all this emotion. But again, two cases in Texas, no notice, very little emotion, and in one case, a six-month-old child is dead already. We're going to open our phones, 866-303-2270. We want to find out what you think about Congress getting involved in the Terry Schiavo case on this level. Is it a good idea? Should Congress continue to get involved in individual cases like this? Or is Congress setting a bad and potentially scary precedent? 866-303-2270. We'll get back to you after the break. Mick Foley is our special guest co-host. My name is Mark Riley, and you're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Good morning. I'm Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Good morning. This is Morning Sedition, 6 past the hour. My name is Mark Riley. Our special guest co-host, wrestling legend, Mr. Mick Foley.
Good That's morning. Me again. That's me.
How you doing?
Mr. Wrestling No Palm Pilot for you, Mick Foley.
Mr. Mick Foley, we're going to be going to you on the telephones. I misspoke earlier when I said that the Florida legislature didn't get involved. I misread something that was in a piece of copy I had. They did apparently try to get involved. They were the legislation they passed apparently was found unconstitutional. That's the Florida legislature,
okay.
not the Congress. The Congress just started getting involved the other week. I mean, they did get involved fairly recently. We're talking, of course, about the Terry Schiavo case. For those of you who are just waking up, at 12:42 a.m., the House of Representatives passed a bill that gave the federal court jurisdiction over whether or not Terry Schiavo's feeding tube would be removed and she would be allowed to die. This woman has been in a coma for a great long period of time. She's been brain damaged since heart failure back in 1990. Her husband wants the feeding tube removed. Her family, her mother and father, and her brothers apparently, want the feeding tube to stay in, or if in the case of it being taken out, reinserted. President Bush signed that legislation at approximately 1:12 this morning.
And, you know, Mark, I'm not necessarily against a federal law. You know, I've pointed out what I think is the hypocrisy of Republicans campaigning on states' rights and then going to the federal law whenever it suits their own purposes. I think in some ways, as a guy who's lived in about 8 different states, maybe there should be a constant when it comes to something as important as this type of heroic measures and what to do in somebody's life, obviously, is being supported medically. Maybe there should be a federal law. I just find it strange that President Bush would overrule his own law that he signed into effect when he was a state governor. But it's certainly something that people feel strongly on both sides. There is a lot of room for argument, and I think that'll probably be reflected in some of the calls that we are about to take.
Looks like there's quite a few people calling. Let's go first to Rob, who's calling us from Brooklyn, listening to WLIB. Rob, are you there? Good morning to you. Wait a minute. Kayla was getting you on the line momentarily. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Mark and Mick. How are you?
All right. How you doing?
Good, good. Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, I know you spoke about the Texas Futile Care Law, which is, you know, so hypocritical for them to now, the Republicans, to come out and state that they're, you know, concerned about Schiavo, whereas, you know, you look at the Medicaid funding recently that wants to be cut, and then you look at what they're doing with the bankruptcy laws. It's quite astonishing for the fact that, you know, in 2000, when Bush campaigned and Republicans in general, they've all spoken about the fact that they wanted a smaller government. That's what they always, you know, campaigned on. And yet Ashcroft, you know, tried to fight Oregon with the assisted suicide law.
Yeah.
And now they're fighting Florida, and it's just so hypocritical. And, you know, it's just a publicity stunt to keep their conservative base happy. And nothing more.
Well, you know, that is, I think, one of the things that folks are looking at in terms of why Congress has decided to get involved in this specific case, and not in the case of six-month-old Son Hudson, who almost nobody in America knows about outside the state of Texas, and maybe not everybody inside the state of Texas. It is amazing to think, Mick, that there is, I mean, in this country, you kind of sort of expect a little bit of inconsistency in terms of legislation and politics, because that's the nature of the beast, but to have a president who, as governor, signed a particular piece of legislation that allowed a hospital, a corporation,
yeah. You know, there's a technical term for what the president has done here. It's called flip-flopping.
Oh, you mean like they did, like they accused John Kerry?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Interesting. I need to go to another call, but my thing went out, so I don't have all the names. Donna, let's go next to Donna. Donna, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
And Donna, you're down there in Florida, so you must have a strong feeling on this matter.
Well, I have a strong feeling, but I have an even stronger feeling about really where this is going and what it's about. And I think what it's about is just another crack away against the abortion laws. Because if you look at Terri Schiavo, they have a woman who's seemingly moving her mouth, who's seemingly, you know, responding to music and things like that. All of the things that people are saying about fetuses.
Yes,
yeah.
Fetuses move, fetuses suck their thumb, fetuses, you know, supposedly respond to the mother's voice, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not a small jump. There's no way Bush would have run back in the middle of the night to sign a law that ordinarily only affects people in the future. Laws, I'm an attorney. Laws, when you change them, don't affect, if it's substantive, it doesn't affect the cases that are now pending. It affects people in the future. So this turns that whole thing on its head, and it just allows it's a crack against it moves towards pro-life. It's not hard to then say, so does the fetus. I guess that's my comment.
No, it's interesting you bring that up and put it that way, because this has become a magnet for right-to-life people from all over the country. You know, DeLay has acted in concert with a lot of right-to-life organizations in pushing for that tube to be reinserted. But, Donna, how much do you think this has to do with the specifics of this case, the husband situation, the struggle between the family? I mean, does that play a role in your judgment?
I really think it's ultimately what they see as the future, where this is going. And I've talked to colleagues, I've spoken with a few doctors, and I really think that it's the bigger picture. It's not the small picture. It's the bigger picture.
All right. Donna, thank you very much.
Mark, does the Right to Life group, do they seem to have anything against people who do make wills claiming they do not want heroic measures? I mean, do they see that as as a form of murder if someone chooses not to have their life supported, if there's no hope for the future?
Some do, some don't. I mean, they have weighed in on cases in the past. They weighed in on Kevorkian and some of the things that he was involved in doing. So, I mean, on a certain level, and you have to, I guess, separate the anti-abortion movement from the political right generally. And you find, I think, in many cases that they pick their opportunity based on what will get them the furthest political mileage. And what gets them furthest along the road toward their end game, which is the overturning of Roe v. Wade. That's their end game
right here.
I mean, when you look at these folks, that is what they really want to get accomplished. And this is just one step on that road.
And the president bringing up the Dred Scott case in the second debate would be was another small step, just to affirm that any type of life in that case, even slaves, were considered human beings.
Yeah.
You know, the president somehow using that to aid his case.
Yeah, it's fascinating what he's using to aid his case. We have a very cynical theory about the Terri Schiavo case. We're going to get to it when we come back. Mick Foley is our special guest. My name is Mark Reilly, and this is Morning Sedition.
This is Congressman Barney Frank, and you're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Do you know?
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Reilly with our special guest co-host, Mr. Mick Foley.
Hello, I'm Mick Foley.
There you go. Mark Maron's on vacation. Good morning, Dallas, Texas. We are on 910 AM KXEB. We're on there live as we speak. So good morning to all of you in the great state of Texas and the city of Dallas. We're talking about the Terri Schiavo case with you on the telephones. 866-303-2270 is the number. We're talking about whether or not you think Congress should get involved. Congress and the President of the United States should get involved middle of the night, middle of the day, or otherwise.
It's got to be important, Riley, for someone to wake up Bush, who insists on being in the sack by 10 o'clock, to wake up the president. I mean, is news in and of itself.
It certainly is. And he came in and signed this bill that gives a federal court jurisdiction over whether or not to remove Terri Schiavo's feeding tube. He did that at 1:12 this morning. Let's go back to our telephones. We got a cynic on the line. Chris is calling us from Teaneck, New Jersey. Chris, good morning.
Good morning. I suggest this is just another wedge issue that these people are doing. Their message to their so-called base is really fading based on the economy and the war, and they're going to continue to create issues like this that really just they have no business in. They defy science. This is not what it appears to be.
Is it a good political issue for the Republicans, as that memo seems to suggest?
It's a great issue because it resurrects the Right to Life people who are getting screwed by with their economic policies. They're just going to keep coming with it. You know, they're going to lay off gay people for a while. They're going to do this thing. Then they're going to go back to the abortion thing. This is these people have a grip on this country that's really very, very, very scary. And they're getting a stronger and stronger grip.
Mick, you had something you wanted
to say. Yeah, I'd like to refer back to our GOP memo. For those of you just tuning in, there was a memo that was meant only to be seen by senators, and we've gotten a hold of it, or actually the Washington Post got a hold of it, and we got it from them. But it specifically says, the memo singled out Senator Bill Nelson, Democrat from Florida, who's up for re-election next year, and that this may be a case where the Republicans really want to spotlight him, put him on the spot, so to speak. So he has to make a decision that may very well be unpopular with many people in the state of Florida. So, again, they're looking at the midterms. I believe this is strictly a political issue. And if it were not for the coverage that we've seen on video of this poor woman, if this were the young man or a young boy in Texas, the six-month-old, who was taken off life support strictly because his family did not have the means to pay for him to be kept alive, we wouldn't even be hearing about Terri Schiavo.
A very good point. And, of course, we had somebody on the line a minute ago. I guess they are no longer there. Let's go to Brenda. Brenda, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
We're in Dallas listening to you on the radio. Yay.
All right.
This is,
Dallas.
This is a new development,
that's right?
Dallas
from KXEB, 9:10 a.m.
Yes, coming in loud and strong.
Oh, yes. Fantastic. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
What do you think?
Well, my question is, what is this costing the taxpayers for them to call this special session?
Well, you know what? I'm not sure we'll ever know. Certainly in terms, I don't know that the legislators get overtime, but the fact of the matter is, there is a cost to doing all this. There's a cost in terms of calling together this special session. There's a cost in terms of getting the president from wherever he was to sign this bill. You're right. There is a cost. And I wonder the extent to which, see, when you start looking at the cases in Texas, where cost apparently played some role in people's decision to end the life of other people, you start realizing maybe money is at the root of all this, huh?
Exactly. And the other thing is, this woman is not on life support. She's just getting food through a feeding tube. So I don't know why they should even address it. I mean, if her parents want to feed her, let them feed her. And if the husband wants to walk away from it, it sounds like he already walked away from it. So, you know, what happened to till death do us part?
I knew, Brenda, that the husband's conduct was an issue in all this. The idea that he's with somebody else, the idea that he has children with somebody else, kind of casts him as a very unsympathetic figure. But you make a very interesting point. Why not let the parents feed the woman if that's what they want to do?
And, Mark, we were discussing in the commercial break whether or not taking a young woman off of a feeding tube and letting her slowly die constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. That does seem kind of barbaric that she's just going to slowly starve to death, and you wonder, even though she doesn't seem to have any mental faculties, whether or not she would feel that and whether that constitutes torture.
My guess is the family would disagree about whether or not she's feeling anything at this point. The husband, certainly by his actions, is trying to say she doesn't feel anything, she doesn't know anything, she's in a vegetative state. The family, her family, the Schindlers, are saying something very different. And I think it's important to make that distinction as we look at this. Let's go to our phones again. Let's go to John, who's calling us from North Miami. John, how you doing?
Okay, how are you all doing?
All right.
That's good. I'm on the side of the Congress and the President on this one. Your screener didn't want me to go into details, but I do encourage you people, the courts, I hope the federal courts do this, to find out just what this her husband did back 15 years ago, with a large sum of money that was supposed to have been for her rehabilitation, which nobody talks about.
You're talking about the $700 settlement that they won?
$700?
Oh, I'm sorry, $700,000 settlement.
Yeah,
that
and
they won.
He spent it on good times and running around and partying and then on courts and everything, and he didn't spend one dime, as I understand it, to rehabilitate her. And people that know about these things claim that if he'd used that $700,000, I think it was $750,000 is the number that I got. Back then, she wouldn't be to this state that she is now. And the federal courts, I hope to goodness they go into that, because from my mind, it questions completely this guy saying, well, she told him, you know, to do this. And
well, John, you know, his lawyers are saying that the money has been spent on health care and legal funds. So I don't know how it was spent. I don't want to assume. I don't know Michael Schiavo, so I have no idea what he did with money. But I think the central issue here is whether or not Congress is overreaching. Yes, this is an emotional issue. People are going to side with Michael Schiavo. People are going to side with the Schindler family, whoever. But bottom line, this is the question here is whether or not the Congress of the United States has any business involving itself in this kind of dispute. Now, you know, one of the previous callers, Mick, said, look, if the family wants to continue to feed her, why not allow that to happen? Is that a problem for you?
I've said I'm with the family on this one. I don't necessarily agree that there should have been a vote, but I'm up in the air as to whether there should be a federal law. As I said, I'm a guy that's lived in several parts of the country and a large part in the southern part of the country. I lived in Tennessee, Texas, Georgia, Alabama, and Florida. Mm-hmm. It seems strange that if I did not have a will, if I were to have suffered some terrible wrestling accident, that I would be kept alive in one state, but allowed to die in another state. So maybe a federal law is best, but I do think it's hypocritical that Bush is overruling himself, that he has, in a sense, flip-flopped on this issue.
This issue is obviously ongoing, and hopefully, and we talked about this off air too, Mick, the idea that they insert the tube, they pull out the tube, they insert the tube, they pull out the tube, depending on which court rules what. Let us hope that this woman finds peace on some level, some way. I mean, it is just incredible to contemplate the Congress of the United States getting itself involved. When we come back, we're going to have our morning remembrance, Mick. It's a very sad time for us here this morning. And we're going to have our morning remembrance grief correspondent in on that. And from the Nation magazine, David Korn joins us to talk Paul Wolfowitz. And you're going to talk about Dinner with Wolfie when
Dinner
we come back.
Dinner with Wolfie.
Here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. Our special guest co-host, Mr. Mick Foley. Good morning, Dallas, Texas. We're on 9:10 a.m. KXEB live Monday through Friday, and we are really honored to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. And unfortunately, it's that time of the week again when we here at Morning's Edition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Thanks, guys. Nicholas M. Salgo, developer. Nicholas Salgo, conservative Republican financier and builder of the infamous Watergate Hotel complex in Washington, is finally checked out. Salgo was the principal developer behind the Watergate Hotel and ingeniously attracted patrons by offering a special discount for any guests willing to, quote, have their dainties fondled by G. Gordon Liddy. I always get this way after eating tomatoes. I'm not crying. Got allergies, you know.
Right.
According to doctors, Salgo was declared dead after reportedly suffering an 18-minute gap in brain activity. You got a tissue, Mark?
Yeah, sure.
Hey, thanks.
For you, anything.
All right. allergies. Anyway, memorial services will be held before 12 noon to avoid being charged for an extra day. Paul Sawyer, NASCAR pioneer. Paul Sawyer, beloved pioneer of NASCAR racing, died this month after realizing he dedicated most of his adult life to the most stultifyingly boring sport on earth. A true visionary, Sawyer helped develop stock car racing from a small regional sport into one of the scariest incarnations of conservative southern thinking since Quantrill's Raiders decided to slaughter 400 abolitionists abolitionists in 1863. Sorry, I just... You wearing a new cologne, Mark? You know how I get after...
Yeah, I understand.
Wild hyacinth or something. I'm allergic to scents. It all began in 1955 when Sawyer bought three small dirt tracks in Virginia and North Carolina and turned them into a state-of-the-art 100,000-seat racing arenas, all kept spotlessly clean by Strom Thurmond's illegitimate black children.
Oh, low blow, Mort.
I just call him as I see him, Mark. Sawyer requested his body be cremated after being hurled 200 miles an hour into a concrete retaining wall. Clothes. That's what does it, the clothes. I'm not crying. Anyway, this has been this week's Morning Remembrance. Until next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying, who's chopping onions?
Mort. Mort.
Yeah.
Illegitimate black children.
Well, you know, Strom Thurmond.
Yes, I understand.
You got it.
I don't know if some of the brothers outside the studio will understand, but that's okay, Mort. No, it's all right. It's all right.
Thank you
for that.
You notice I stayed suspiciously quiet during the whole NASCAR thing.
Yeah.
Realizing that that's my base, man.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Well, we had somebody, there was a black face right outside the studio waiting for you, Mort. But that's okay.
Good luck.
Good luck. Enjoy yourself. Whoop. Ooh. Well, that's okay. Anyway, we've got a very special guest who's joining us on our telephone lines live from Tacoma Park, Maryland. He is the Washington editor for The Nation magazine. We're going to talk all about Paul Wolfowitz with David Korn. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
Thank you so much for being with us. Say good morning to Mick Foley.
Good morning, Mick.
Hello, David. How are you? Now, I may have to weigh in personally here because I don't know if you've been listening.
I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that.
Is that you're talking to somebody who has been a dinner guest of Wolfie's?
Does he pick the food between his teeth? How do I do that information? It's
really
not relevant to me.
Oh, man. What happened was I was sitting behind him, and I'll be real brief because I know you have a lot to say. Sitting behind him at the groundbreaking ceremony for Walter Reed's new amputee wing. Unfortunately, there is a need for a new wing because of all the amputees coming in. I was trying to think of what I would say to this guy who I'm not particularly fond of, and I realized that I couldn't say, hello, Mr. Wolfowitz, it's nice to meet you, but that I could say, hello, how are you? I know the troops appreciate your support. So a week later, I was introduced to him as a surprise introduction. I turned around, and there he was, and I stuck out my hand. I said, hello, Mr. Wolfowitz. How are you? I know the troops appreciate your support. And then a week after that, I was invited to dinner at Mr. Wolfowitz's request at the Pentagon.
Whoa.
So there's my personal Paul Wolfowitz story.
And when you met him the second time, you said, hello, Mr. Wolfowitz, how are you? I'm sure the troops appreciate your presence. Right for the time I was once in an elevator with Henry Kissinger, and all I could think of saying was something like, you. I do have a lot to say about Wolfowitz and his appointment to the World Bank, but it can be summed up rather neatly.
Mm-hmm.
This is the guy who told us that the intelligence was rather convincing there was weapons of mass destruction when it wasn't. This is a guy who told us that oil sales could finance the war and the reconstruction of Iraq when they couldn't. This was a guy who told us that Iraq would welcome us the way that France welcomed the liberators in the 1940s up in the United States, and they didn't. And this was a guy who, when General Shinseki, the Army General Chief of Staff, before the war, said we would need hundreds of thousands of troops to secure Iraq afterwards, said, nah, not a problem. And so my issue is, my God, what did the World Bank do to deserve to get him? I mean, after screwing up the war with this record of miscalculation and exaggeration, he doesn't really seem to have the judgment to handle the World Bank. You know, it's an institution I'm not particularly fond of. I think it's been very problematic over the years. But
well, David, let's stop there and explain to our audience exactly what the World Bank does.
It runs the world. It runs about $20 billion a year in what's supposed to be poverty remediation efforts to the poorer nations of the world. And there's been a lot of complaints over the years from both left and right now, that the World Bank, that the loans come with so many strings attached that they tie the hands of the nations that get the money, that often they force them to go down these paths of privatization and deep cuts and social investments like education and health care in order to have, to bring their budgets into line with what the World Bank wants, and that the World Bank has had a preference for these large projects like gigantic dams that destroy, huge swaths of a country in order to sort of bring in foreign investment. And so those are sort of the basic criticisms, and I think they're fundamentally true, and that they haven't cared much about the environmental consequences of the projects they fund. To be fair, I think the World Bank has slowly, emphasis on the word slowly, been somewhat responsive to some of these claims. But at the same time, you have this guy, Jim Wolfensohn, who's leaving as the World Bank president. And I recently met, I think he was the chief economist for the IMF, which is the International Monetary Fund, like the World Bank, who has become a critic of the World Bank. And he wrote a piece recently in which he said that Jim Wolfensohn, his own PR shop at the World Bank in America, has 400 people working in it. 400 people doing just PR for the World Bank when they should be helping the poor. And when his piece came out, he got a call from the World Bank. He said, no, you're wrong. It's 270.
Wow. Gee, splitting hairs, huh?
I don't think they're doing a lot to get that PR. So, and the other thing that's wrong with the Wolfowitz nomination is indeed the message it sends to the rest of the world. I think he stands for the arrogance and the hubris that pushed us into war. And, you can step back and say, whether the rest of the world is right or wrong to see the U.S. in that fashion, it still is a matter that we should be concerned with. And of all the people in the world who we could place in this job, after nominating someone like John Bolton to be head of the U.N., a big U.N. basher, why stick another finger in the eye of the allies that Bush claims? I mean, is he telling the truth or not? That he claims he wants to be working with in places like Syria and in Iraq as well.
David Korn is our guest. He is the Washington editor for The Nation magazine. He's also author of The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. Before we go to break real quickly, David, how bad does the Wolfowitz choice seem to governments in South America, which seem to be trying to coalesce around doing more business with themselves and perhaps trying to get the World Bank off their back?
Well, we don't really have too much of an indication of what direction he's going to take World Bank policy. And one fear people have, because he's so identified with the Bush administration and with the war in Iraq and with sort of heavy-handed diplomacy, that he will use the World Bank to, lean on countries in South America or any place to follow and back U.S. policy. Elsewhere, World Bank presidents in the past have not always been people who've come right out of an administration. While the U.S. president traditionally gets to appoint the person, it's not like an administration job. And so the fact that, Wolfowitz is there, I think it's going to cause people to sort of, nations of the world to sort of scratch their head when they are looking for assistance from the World Bank, and the U.S. is on top of them for other matters. Like maybe they don't want them screaming as much about, say, global warming.
Yeah. David, we got to take a break. But when we come back, I want to ask you whether or not a couple of elements of Paul Wolfowitz's personal life might jeopardize this particular appointment to the World Bank. David Korn is our guest. He's Washington editor for The Nation magazine. Stay with us. We'll be right back here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition,
the highest rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
50 past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley with our very special guest on the telephone, the Washington editor of The Nation magazine, Mr. David Corn. He's also author of the book, The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. Mick, you have a question for David?
Yeah, David, I'd like to know what one person possibly has to do to get fired from the Defense Department.
Well, apparently it's not shoot yourself in the foot. Because as we know, the Wolfowitz has done that several times in the past. No, it's sort of like what happened with George Tenet when he got that Medal of Freedom Award. The Wolfowitz got the same one. It's now widely acknowledged. In fact, the administration uses it as a crutch to say that the CIA messed up on the intelligence on weapons of mass destruction. Actually, you know, the White House is sort of doing a little bit of a dodgy number here, because if you look at the intelligence that was produced and you look at the statements that the White House made, they took that weak or faulty intelligence and they made the matter even worse. But for that, for producing that bad intelligence, George Tenet, the CIA director, got a Medal of Freedom Award from the president, and at the same ceremony, so did Paul Wolfowitz.
Now, we've seen in the past, I think, that President Bush's feeling is that to admit any wrongdoing or any mistakes would be seen as a sign of weakness. Back when LBJ appointed Robert McNamara as president of the World Bank, even though it's technically a promotion, is it not? Is it not a more important position in the world? There was a feeling that he was gracefully easing McNamara out of the Defense Department. Could that be the case here? Could Bush possibly be realizing Wolfowitz isn't the best guy to have in that spot, and he's shifting him to another area in the world?
Well, you are an optimist. I think this is in the second term of a two-term administration that we have now. Someone like Wolfowitz has to, for his own career's sake, has to run something. After being the number two guy at the Pentagon for all this time, you know, he needs to step up on the pyramid, on that career pyramid, as any consultant would tell him. And, you know, if Rumsfeld's not leaving, and even if Rumsfeld did leave, I'm not sure they put Wolfowitz in the number one position because of all these issues we've talked about. So he really has to sort of become a top dog himself somewhere else. The World Bank is exactly the right sort of position for someone looking to make that move. And, you know, it's a 10-year job. It's three times the pay I think he's getting at the Pentagon. And you get all these great perks. Celeste, the outgoing World Bank president, got to play cello with Yo-Yo Ma. So maybe Paul Wolfowitz will get to jam with, you know, Santana or somebody. I don't know, but, you know, it's a celebrity-type position. So I don't think, I don't read this at all as a sign of White House unease. With Wolfowitz, and they're trying to get him up to the side. I mean, if you couple this, if you look at this appointment at the same time as you look at the appointment of John Bolton to the UN, it shows that the neocons still have tremendous influence within the Bush administration and are getting, most importantly, I think, the jobs that they want.
Is there any chance that Wolfowitz's high profile will put a spotlight on the problems in developing countries? Can any good come out of this at all?
Well, the upbeat, the positive spin is that Wolfowitz, you know, who has thought about economic development in the past as a ambassador to Indonesia and who people keep claiming is an intellectual powerhouse, although I think his hubris and arrogance certainly got in the way when it came to Iraq, that he may bring sort of a force of personality to the World Bank and not be tied into the, you know, the existing way of how they do things, and might be a Nixon to China type, might be a Nixon to China type deal, that he might be able to bring about reforms and get the bank to actually do things. And since he has the, you know, good connections to the White House, he'll have some influence to get done what he wants to have done. Listen, at this stage, all I think we have left is hope.
Exactly.
So why not hope for that? I mean, I don't think the Europeans, although they've been very upset about this, are going to put up a big fight. He's going to Europe apparently to meet with some of the board members, the European board members of the World Bank. But I spoke to somebody who knows the French ambassador here in town a day or two, said that they didn't think the French were going to put up a big fight to this. They have too many other things going on with the United States. So at this stage, we may as well hope, you know, that things go better. I mean, I'm happy to be proven wrong if it's good for the world.
But
know?
David, now what about these allegations of an affair
with a, quote, Arab feminist, unquote, and questions about whether or not Paul Wolfowitz is married or divorced. Have you heard anything about this? There's a story in the Daily Mail today, isn't it?
Can I admit a story?
Mick Foley broke this story.
I was on the plane from England, and I was reading the Daily Mail. I tried to read The Guardian because they gave me a good book review last year, but only the Mail was available, and the headline says, "Will a British divorcee cost Wolfie his job?"
Well, it kind of... I mean, it's been in the papers down here in town that he's had a relationship with a woman who works at the bank.
Yes.
And if he got the job, obviously there'd have to be all these sort of provisions so she can be favored. But I doubt very much it's going to queer the deal. I do think that, you know, what I understand, though I haven't paid a lot of attention to this, is that he separated from his wife, I think, a pretty long time ago. I don't know if they're officially divorced or not. But if, you know, if we didn't care, you know, if we didn't think impeachment was worth a BJ in the White House, I would certainly give him a pass on this, as long as everything was done right internally so there could be no favoritism shown to his, you know, squeeze.
Apparently some members of the World Bank claim that she played a key role in pushing Wolfowitz into the Iraq War. And that's something, because my wife and I thought we were pulling off a coup when we planned our Disney trip.
You know, my wife gets me to do all sorts of things that I don't want to do. But you know, Wolfowitz was long on record. I mean, you know, being in favor of this, and it certainly was. It was no surprise. It was no surprise that he pushed the war so hard. Maybe she got him to believe more intensely than he should have that everything would fall into place. But nevertheless, he stayed. You know, he's responsible for his own actions. As I am, even when I follow my wife's advice.
David Korn, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a very, very enlightening time with you this morning.
You know, let me just ask people to visit my blog. It's davidkorn.com.
Yes. All right. You take care now. David Korn, Washington editor for The Nation magazine. When we come back, Mick Foley. We're going to talk about your dinner with Wolfie. We're going to talk about Condoleezza Rice. And we've got Bruce Weber to talk wrestling in the final hour.
And we can talk about my crush on The Nation's Katrina Vandenhoevel.
All right. This is Air America Radio. Six minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation this week. He'll be back next Monday. My special guest co-host is New York Times bestselling author, former WWE champion, Mr. Mick Foley.
Time's just flying here, Riley. It's been, unless I'm mistaken, unless I'm really delusional, things are going pretty well, right?
Well, things are going well, and you're delusional. No. No, it is. It's going real well. Let's say good morning to Dallas, Texas. We're on 910 a.m. KXEB live, and we know that because we got a call from Dallas earlier this morning.
Nice.
So we're on the air. We're being heard loud and clear.
Mark, could we sway the election there in 2006, this station?
Yeah, why not? I'd like to sway elections all over the country.
As Gorilla Monsoon used to say, highly unlikely.
Hey, you never know.
But this could be the pebble that causes the ripple.
There you go.
That causes a giant wave.
Mark Maron is going to be performing at Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco Friday and Saturday, April 1st and 2nd. All of you listening to 960 AM The Quake in San Francisco, come check it out. Go to the tour date pages of morningsedition.com for information and for tickets. Sign petitions against the Bush administration's propaganda and fake news at the links page on morningsedition.com. Mick Foley, a lot of things going on in our world. Later this morning, we're going to be talking with Bruce Weber from the New York Times about a piece he wrote talking about someone I think that you know a little bit about, a guy by the name of Harley Race.
Yes, yeah, I heard a few days ago that the New York Times had done a story on Harley Race's wrestling school. Harley is a legend in that business. We throw that name around, that word around legend, pretty lightly in our business, probably in every business.
Yeah.
Some people even refer to me as being...
You are a legend. Mick Foley is a legend. Everybody knows
that. The hardcore legend, but Harley is one of those guys who just, you know, respected by everybody. You know, there's Harley Race stories that I heard years before I got in the business.
Really?
You
know?
Yeah, you want a quick Harley
Race
story?
Yeah, give me a quick Harley Race story.
In my book, I referred to putting the fear of Harley into people. He certainly put the fear of Harley into me. I remember, just for example, I'll spread a little inside information here. Back when I was going to be a good guy You know, I was going to run through the crowd and hit Vader, who was the head bad guy, in the back with a scoop shovel. Now, in all my years of wrestling training, nobody had ever shown me how to use a scoop shovel, which was steel at that time. We later went to the aluminum one, and we found out it caused less damage, but still hurt considerably. No one ever taught me how to hit somebody with a scoop shovel, so I was kind of backstage and kind of, like, trying to figure out how I could do it on a wall, and like, not that impressive. And Harley walks up to me. Harley was Vader's manager.
Okay.
Harley was the guy who knew that if this doesn't look good, you know, we don't sell tickets. And Harley walks up to me and he says, if you don't hit him, I'm coming back here and I'm going to hit you. You better believe it. I went running through that crowd. And Vader was the guy who said, I feel no pain. I fear no man. That was his big catchphrase.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, I feel no pain. Bam! He went, ah! So suffice to say, there was no reason for Harley to hit me. But there was a time in Baltimore, Maryland. Maryland had a state athletic commission that would take care of any wrestler's injury as long as it happened within the ring.
Okay.
And as you know from watching this stuff, I did a lot of stuff outside
out of the
ring. And I also had a
above
style.
The ring.
Yeah, yeah. All
miles
over the ring,
from
everywhere,
the ring.
Anywhere but in the ring. And I was a veteran of many late-night emergency room visits because I had a style that that left very little room for error. If I messed up, I got hurt. And in this case, I had split my eyebrow open outside on a guardrail. And we came back in, and there was this old member of the Maryland Athletic Commission. He goes, hey, Mick, it's too bad that happened outside the ring because now we can't take care of it. And Harley says to him, he goes, it was a headbutt, and it happened in the ring. And the guy goes, oh, come on, Harley, I saw it. And Harley goes, I said it was a headbutt. And it happened inside the ring. And the guy says, okay, we're going to take care of everything. And sure enough, I went to the hospital.
Went to the hospital.
Athletic Commission took care of everything. But Bruce Weber wrote an article. He did wrote an excellent article. I've got an issue with a couple of things.
Well, a couple of things. But, you know, I wonder if Harley Race said to him, Bruce, you better write a good article. You know, I mean, I wouldn't want to mess with him.
No, because I learned the power of the New York Times back when they did an article on me a few years ago when my second book hit number one. And I just thought, okay, the Times is a real popular newspaper. I didn't realize the influence it carried. And literally, the day it came out, the phone started ringing, and television shows like the Today Show that said they, you know, they didn't weren't interested in a wrestler suddenly were interested because
Mick Foley.
As the New York Times goes, so goes the world. So I hope that this does a lot to give a little respect towards my industry or my former industry and to Harley as well because he's a great guy.
Well, you know what? I will admit to the fact that I have been watching wrestling since I was about 8 years old, okay? I go back to the Haystacks, Calhoun, Bobo, Brazil days.
Because when I first showed up here, your face lit up when I was aghast. And
And
Maron was like, who's this hairy guy? Yeah.
No, man, because I followed your career. I watched you on the top of those steel cages doing stuff that I thought was going to put you, well, probably did end up putting you in a hospital more than once. But, I mean, just it seemed like you had this devil-may-care attitude. And the interesting thing to me, too, was, you know, they at the steroids hearing last week, they had Curt Schilling come in. Now, sure. Curt Schilling is a guy who is, you know, really against steroids. They brought him in largely because he was a good person to talk to about it. And you are a person that is never going to be confused with a steroid taker. And I wondered if they called you.
You see me with my shirt off. There's a story about when we were tested in Atlanta back when I was working for WCW.
Okay.
And a wrestler, I wasn't allowed to print this in my book because I couldn't get a hold of the guy. And he was disappointed when I found out I couldn't be in there. So his name was Brian Knobs. And he turned up.
Oh, yeah, Knobs and Skaggs.
And, not Skaggs. Sags.
Yeah, Sags, Knobs and Sags. There you go.
Knobs and Sags sounds like one of my former girlfriends.
Hopefully she's not listening.
And he found out that he tested positive on the drug test. And he was, like, frankly surprised that his cup hadn't melted, you know. And he says, all right, what'd you get me for? And the guy says, steroids. And he goes, steroids? So you've seen Knobs, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he's got the musculature of a jellyfish. And Sags literally took off his shirt, and he said, does it look like I'm on steroids? And the doctor in the lab coat took down his pen and goes, oh, obviously there's been some mistake. So I'm probably in that same boat. Maybe not quite jellyfish-esque, but certainly I'm not somebody who's going to be, accused of steroid use.
Well, we're going to talk to Bruce Weber a little bit later on about following Harley Race's wrestling school and his organization across the state of Missouri and some other places. You, I believe, said a little bit earlier in the broadcast that you're going to be doing some work with Harley Race further down the road as well.
Yeah, there's a list, a small list of people who really helped me out when I was younger, you know, major guys who took an interest in me, and I try, you know, now that I've had some success to, you know, to give back to them. And Harley does a great job. I mean, they said in the article a lot of the Little League equipment in the town of Eldon is purchased through Harley's shows. So he's always looking for a reputable charity. I think the one I'm doing for him on April 1st is the United Way.
Okay.
And so there's not many guys that wrestlers will go out of their way to spend a day off for free. Working for. That's probably the least grammatical sentence the New York Times bestselling author will ever say. But I think you get the gist of it. But we all really respect the guy and like him a great deal. And so, like I said, I'm glad to see you got some coverage
in
the esteemed New York Times.
And we're looking forward to talking with Bruce Weber, mixed beef and all, coming up in the last half hour of the program. When we come back, Condoleezza Rice is in Asia, trying to get the Chinese back on board. Oh, here we go now.
No.
I guess
You know what that does? That takes my Vandenhoevel crush and diminishes it.
Oh,
so
okay.
I must say that I'm kidding about the Condoleezza thing. She does seem to be a little icy. Obviously very intelligent. A little icy, that black S&M dress notwithstanding.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I'm serious about the Vandenhoevel thing.
Oh, okay. Not Condoleezza, but Vandenhoevel.
Right. Have you heard the Steve Earle song, Condi?
Yes.
Very nice.
He has a show here. You know.
I know. I was on it.
You were on that,
yeah,
too?
Yeah.
Turncoat. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Coming up on 20 minutes past the hour, this is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. Our special guest co-host, wrestling legend and best-selling author, Mr. Mick Foley.
Yes, this is going well. I'm really enjoying myself.
You having fun?
But more importantly, are people out there having fun, you know, listening?
Listening. That is the important point.
Or are they so attached to Maron at this point that I'm seen as a weak imitation?
An interloper?
If you guys would give me that... Darn, can I say D-A-M-N on this show? I don't even know with the FCC. That darn Palm Pilot, I'd be having even more fun.
Oh, that's right. I
was shown the Marin fans how that thing's supposed to be read.
Whoa! Mick Foley throwing down the gauntlet. I guess you must be following the tradition of our Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, who is throwing down gauntlets in China as we speak, Mick.
Man.
It's some interesting stuff.
Yeah, she was highlighting religious rites at a church in China. She's a very religious person, grew up as a preacher's daughter, I guess was attending Palm Sunday services.
Yeah, at a Christian church in China, one of the government-sanctioned Christian churches in China. But you know what? She's got a very interesting mission going on here. Back in the run-up to the war in Iraq, the American government made the silly mistake of accusing North Korea of selling selling nuclear technology, something called uranium hexafluoride, to Libya. That's what the United States said, all right? It apparently turns out that information was erroneous. It was, in fact, sold to our good friend Pakistan, not to Libya.
Oh.
Okay? Now, the problem with this, of course, is that as far as the Chinese are concerned, what kind of credibility does the American government have if they can't get straight who they're accusing the North Koreans of selling nuclear material?
Listen, Mark, it just goes back to the fact you don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud.
No, you certainly do not. Now, what Ms. Rice, Secretary Rice, is
Doctor.
Hoping... Dr. Rice. Dr. Secretary Rice. What they're hoping here is that she will be able to talk the Chinese into talking the North Koreans into returning to multilateral talk.
Now, I have a question. You know, Bill Clinton, when he left office, said his two biggest regrets were not getting more involved in Rwanda and doing something quicker, and opting to try to facilitate the Middle East peace process instead of going and speaking with North Korea. Because Madeleine Albright went, and she did not paint Kim Jong-il. I always get him and his dad confused. Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il. She did not paint him as the madman that he's been portrayed in many parts of our media. And she portrayed him as someone who really wanted to talk to Clinton. What do we gain through not negotiating directly with North Korea? It's what I term kind of cold shoulder diplomacy. It's like eighth grade gym class, I'm not talking to you.
You know, that's a very interesting point, Mick, because it was one of the things that John Kerry and George W. Bush disagreed on vehemently during the last campaign, whether or not there should be bilateral, that is North Korea-U.S. direct talks, or whether this six-nation deal, the multilateral approach, was the only way that you would get North Korea to do anything. Now, the fact is, the multilateral talks haven't produced anything.
No.
The North Koreans aren't saying, oh, well, okay, since you all came to the table, we've made an agreement. That hasn't happened.
You know, I think if you're the president, you pride yourself on leadership abilities, then you take the lead and you go over there and you talk to the guy. He takes the tack, the president does, that he doesn't deal with terrorists. But former President Carter said, well, if you don't deal with terrorists, then with whom do you deal? Only nice people? I think potentially the fate of part of the world is at stake with a nuclear armed North Korea, that our president needs to go over there and have some type of conversation. You don't rely on China and Japan to do your work for you. You go over there and you open up talks bilaterally.
Yeah, but see, now what's interesting about this, Mick, is that Condoleezza Rice is in China, and supposedly today she's going to be talking with Chinese leaders about democratic change and about freedom of religion. Now, does that sound to you like incentives to get the Chinese to intercede here?
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. I'm not sure that the Chinese might not jump up and say, you know what, don't come here lecturing us about it unless you want our help with something.
You know, when I was here last time, I was able to talk to Samantha Power, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize winner, A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide. And she said that part of the reason the world wasn't stepping up on the Darfur region is because you had some people there on the Security Council, like China and like Russia, who had their own human rights problems that they didn't want spotlighted.
Yeah.
And I think we've backed off to a great degree on the progress we seem to be making, especially when Hillary Clinton went to Beijing almost 10 years ago. You hear very little about progress in human rights. I know I went over to China as a volunteer for Operation Smile.
Yeah.
And they work on children with facial problems, facial abnormalities, and they provide free work for kids around there. And I don't have a medical background at all, so my job was to check the kids in. And little by little, I came to see that there were no girls being checked in, that it was only boys.
Only boys.
Most of them were orphans. And it seems that, you're talking about the poorest of the poor and the most unwanted children in the world, because in a lot of places in the world, the facial deformality is seen as as almost being evil. And I asked, what about the girls? And I was told through people who know that country well that they are such a source of shame, the ones with facial problems, that they are not even allowed out to seek help. And I just hope that if Dr. Rice is over there, you know, that she can maybe make some inroads. Because I don't think we can really count on China as our partner unless they're willing to clean up their own backyard.
See, that's kind of the paradox that U.S. foreign policy runs into time and time and time again. It's true with Pakistan. It's true in China, where you make these deals with the devil and you end up overlooking huge numbers of allegations of rights violations on some very, very basic levels. You can't go to the Chinese and say, on the one hand, I want your help with something, but while I'm at it, you know, you got some problems here that you ought to be fixing. From a, from a public standpoint, from a foreign policy standpoint, it's a non-starter.
Sure.
They won't cooperate under those circumstances. They have a certain level of national pride that will not allow an American to come over there and tell them how to conduct their government, how to conduct their country, and then at the same time say, oh, and by the way, we need your help with another country that we don't talk to. That's what we seem to be dealing with. That's what she seems to be dealing with in her trip over there. Now, I don't know whether she'll be successful. I guess, you know, as an American, you might want to hope that something good comes out of this, at the very least, some hard and fast data on exactly what the North Koreans are up to. But my guess is the Chinese have no incentive to cooperate, at least not yet. When we come back, we're going to talk to Bruce Weber, that is, about wrestling. And about the Harley Race School of Wrestling. When we come back here on Air America Radio.
Boarding Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Hi, 34 past the hour, it's Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Our special guest co-host, wrestling legend Mick Foley. Mark Maron is on vacation. He'll be back next Monday. But, you know, he does a little something-something every Monday morning, and he didn't want people who needed it and who were used to listening to it to be without it.
Bounce your boobies?
No.
That's not Marin's deal?
That's not Marin. That was, that's right. That's Randy Rhoads.
Can we play it anyway?
you want to give Randy? Anyway, here is Mark Maron.
You know, we know a lot of people out there out of work and spent your Sunday leafing through the want ads or monster.com, and we want to help out. We want to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. So here's our Morning Sedition Monday job listing. Master of ceremonies. The Catholic Church needs someone to preside over our all-important Easter week ceremonies. This is strictly a temporary position. You will be filling in for a sick employee. The ideal candidate must be comfortable juggling disparate tasks such as comparing abortion to the Holocaust while representing an organization that never condemned the Nazis while they were perpetuating the actual Holocaust. Applicants should be able to delegate authority appropriately, such as by keeping women out of authority and keeping serial pedophiles in authority by transferring them from office to office in a molester shell game. Finally, applicants should be able to articulate company policies, such as the maxim that homosexual marriages are part of a new ideology of evil, and to say this publicly while wearing an outfit that would make Elton John roll his eyes. Sorry, but we cannot offer health coverage. We're spending a fortune to keep this last guy ticking.
As you can see, Mark Maron is a lover of religion. You know, he holds it in high esteem, high regard.
When I was on here, don't get me wrong, we had a good time. We got along well. But as you can see, I'm wearing a shirt. You might want to tell the people out there.
Santa's Village.
Santa's Village. I'm a big Christmas guy, you know. I'm a big believer. And Maron is a little more secular than I am. So he went at it a little bit, but in a friendly type of way.
In a friendly type way? Okay. So because you could beat his behind. So he wasn't going to argue with you, but so far.
I think I could beat his behind. Better. If not, I'll lose all my street cred.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
I can't take Maron.
Uh-oh. Well, you know, he's going to be back next week. You're going to be back tomorrow.
Yes, yeah.
And we'll be glad to have you.
It's a two-day gig. And one thing I'm really excited about is talking to Professor Robert Thompson, who is the preeminent expert on television and popular culture. He's a guy you've probably read quotes from hundreds of times without realizing it. And he also happens to have been my favorite professor when I was in college. He went on to much greater things. He moved 30 miles up the road from Cortland to Syracuse, 30 miles and 300 SAT points.
Uh-oh.
And he is a very respected man in that field of television, and he's going to be talking with us tomorrow.
Fantastic. Right now, we are pleased to be talking to Bruce Weber, a reporter in the News and Culture Department of the New York Times. He wrote an article last week on a certain wrestling school in Missouri that was run by somebody Mick Foley knows quite well. Good morning, Bruce Weber. How you doing?
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Bruce, how are you?
All right, which one is which? Who am I talking to here?
I'm Mark.
Okay.
And I'm Mick. And we sound similar, right?
Yeah.
We don't look similar.
And you've got similar names, so I remain confused.
I'm the guy who will be mad at you.
Okay. That's how I figured I would tell the difference.
I might first start out. I was not aware of the power of the New York Times. In 2001, I was fortunate to have a book I wrote hit number one, and my publicist called me up and she said, I've got great news. And I said, what is it? She goes, the Times is going to interview you. And I said, oh, that is great. And she said, no, you don't understand. This is, it is as big as it can get for some for a writer. And sure enough, when that article came out, written by Denisha Smith, I don't know if you...
Oh, sure, Denisha's a pal.
If you could please extend an apology from me to her. Denisha and I got along wonderfully, so wonderfully that when I was on Millionaire, I tried to enlist her as my lifeline. And she politely declined. But then, and this was for 9/11 charities, and so... I was so gung-ho about it. I'd actually hit 125,000 when we went off the air, and I started calling her and leaving messages. And
she thinks you're a stalker.
I think that's possible. And then I tried leaving apologies, but I haven't heard from her. And just tell her it was out of the goodness of my heart. I got carried away, and I abused the friendship, and I'm sorry.
Well, you know, she's been talking about nothing else.
There you go.
So I don't know. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get through.
Now, Bruce, what was it that drove you to do a piece on Harley Race's wrestling school?
Actually, it was my photographer.
Really?
It was his idea. Fred Conrad. He had run across some black and white photographs of extreme wrestlers in a book called, and I actually have it right here. It was called One Ring Circus by someone named Brian Howell. And these were really kind of sort of bloody pictures, and I didn't really much want any part of that, you know, to go into one of these towns
sure.
where they do extreme wrestling and beat each other with, you know, with railroad spikes and things. I looked around for what we were interested in was going back. It was sort of time traveling, going back in time and finding a. Sort of a wrestling environment that would remind us of the black and white TV we watched when we were growing up.
Old school wrestling.
Yeah.
Well, can I say as a guy who is in that profession that you could not have made a better choice. There are a lot of shysters out there, guys willing to take money with very... A lot of times they don't mean to be a shyster, but they don't know how to teach.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what everybody was telling me out there. I mean, actually, you are not telling me anything that other people that I spoke to also didn't say. And, you know Harley pretty well, right?
Yeah, very well, yes.
So you know that he's the real thing. He's a completely genuine guy and believes in, you know, wrestling as a kind of craft, if not an actual art form. And, you know, there's no bull about him, and he's actually kind of a wonderful guy to hang around for 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, he's a legitimate piece of Americana. one thing I was impressed with Mr. Weber is that as a guy who, you know, tries to read as much mainstream stuff as there is out there about wrestling, I've become so conditioned to seeing, like, the final cheap shot.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that no matter how positive an article is, there's always some little, double entendre there or some little... little joke at the end, and I'll say that you, not a double entendre, but, you know, a cheap
one
shot.
One last kick in the butt.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all fake.
And, yeah, and usually a reporter tried, I'm specifically thinking of when World News and Business, what is the U.S.
U.S. News and World
US
Report.
News and World Report did a cover story, and the woman made it so clear that, okay, I'm covering this, but I am way above it, and I really respect the fact that you treated it with respect and you didn't portray yourself as being above it.
Well, no, I was, and that's because I don't think I am. I can't say that I didn't go into this with a certain amount of skepticism. You were talking about Harley being a teacher. I think one of the things that he actually taught me is that there's more there than meets the eye.
Yeah. I think that, you know, you may have gone in with skepticism, but you didn't allow that to cloud your writing.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment. And
all right, now here's where I get angry, okay?
All right,
here we go.
I knew there was a butt coming up, but go ahead.
You know what? Maybe I'll save my anger. Maybe we'll keep things...
Let's save your anger for a second. Let me ask Bruce Weber about the school itself. Well, I mean, I think most people's impression of wrestling is the WWE.
Right.
How does that contrast with what you saw at Harley Race's wrestling school?
Well, this is you know, this is a pretty what seems to me that what characterizes the WWE is its production values. You know, they everybody looks absolutely great. The special effects are worthy of you know, Broadway, the Phantom of the Opera.
Riley, I don't think you've seen what I look like.
Have you ever seen Mick Foley?
Yeah.
So you
hey, I'm trying to you know, I'm trying to give you a, I'm trying to ease into the anger part of
it. Okay.
And it, you know, that it is all it's presented on a scale of very slick entertainment, but that is not what the Harley race is.
Yeah, Harley's his motto is shut up and wrestle.
That's right.
And I know he likes me, but I can't help feeling that I'm one of those guys that as my body began wearing down, I began talking a lot more about how tough I was and proving it a lot less.
Oh, wow.
So if I had shut up completely, I would have been out of a job. But, you know, I was fortunate. I had a guy who really trained me in the essentials. And more than that, Dominic DiNucci is my teacher. He told me.
Oh, Dominic DiNucci!
Dominic DiNucci. And he told me two things that were really important. He said, don't think you're going to make your living out of doing this BS. And, you know, he said the full word.
Right.
And he said, if you, you know, I won't teach you unless you stay in college. And at that point, I thought, well, of course I'm leaving college. This is my dream, you know. And so he became a great influence. And one of the things I tell the guys when they ask me for advice, I tell them, try to enjoy the ride. And I let them know that you're entering a field where very few people are going to make it, and the odds of making it are very low, and the odds of getting hurt seriously along the way are very high.
Yeah.
So if they keep the, you know, their eyes open and appreciate what's going on, they can have a really good wrestling experience without ever becoming a star. And I think Harley tries to put that into them as well, that it's not all about being a star. It's about treating the business with respect and getting something out of it.
That's pretty well put. And the you know, the guys that I met, the wrestlers who were there, they seem to fit into that category pretty well. I mean, and they actually say similar things to that, which I think is a testament to Harley and the fact that they listen to him.
Bruce, we're going to take a break. We have to take a quick break.
And then I'm going to get angry.
And then Mick Foley's going to get angry with Bruce Weber, our special guest from the New York Times. Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Coming up on 50 past the hour, this is Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley with our guest co-host, wrestling legend Mick Foley, who's going to be with us tomorrow.
So come back. And right now, a very angry, angry wrestling legend. Because Mr. Weber, you said in your article...
Now, Bruce Weber
just,
is...
Wait. Just recall that I'm, you know, I'm 51 years old and not in very good shape.
Oh, so it wouldn't be much of a match. Right now, I'm even angrier.
Bruce Weber is from the New York Times. He wrote a piece about Harley Race's wrestling school.
All right. It says... they pay for 6 months of astonishingly bruising instruction in the hopes of someday becoming a star in the gym-buffed, sexuality-saturated, expensively costumed world of big-time televised wrestling. Now, you're going to have to take Riley's word for it here, but he's sitting here looking right at me. And do I appear to you to be either gym-buffed?
No.
Sexuality-saturated?
I'll have to talk to the missus.
Or expensively costumed?
He's got a Santa Claus t-shirt on, Bruce.
And now the other thing, I'm just kidding about that, but something I found interesting was not something that's in the story directly, but a question in an interview you did where you were asked if you think there's a red state, blue state divide with wrestling, and what were your feelings on that?
An interview that I did?
Well, it was kind of like a pre-interview.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
This is a the red state, blue state thing is something that can only get somebody into trouble. But I think that what I was talking about was that wrestling, professional wrestling, does not exactly have a stronghold in New York City. There was a if there is a media bias, Mick, that you were talking about earlier. about wrestling. It probably exists in New York, where we are all so sophisticated that the theater of the sort of theater of brutality, which is kind of what I've come to think of wrestling.
Now, what would you say if I told you that Madison Square Garden has been the hottest arena for professional wrestling for over 50 years?
Yeah.
Now, granted, we're drawing from a large crowd, and a lot of the reason. Now, I ask this because Riley and I were talking a little bit about why I decided to even, like, come out of the closet and expose myself as being a progressive, so to speak.
A liberal!
And I'll be honest, if I was still making my living, if I was a professional wrestler and I was, that's how I supported my family, I probably would have shut up. You know, because there are people who take offense to somebody coming out, and a lot of issues that are, you know, thought to be progressive are not thought to be cool by a lot of people out there in the red states. But my feeling was that we draw from a very diverse crowd, and that we are representing an awful lot of people that I feel are voting against their best interests. That the wrestling was real popular in the South, where once upon a time poor whites voted Democrat.
Right.
And it really pains me to go out there. And I made a joke, you know, when I was in Alabama in December. And I said, I was talking about going to Iraq to visit the troops. And I said, now, I'll never be confused as a staunch pro-war supporter. As a matter of fact, I still got a box load of John Kerry.
You're the Hanoi Jane of the Iraq, War.
The fans started booing me in Alabama, but it was a friendly boo. It wasn't like an angry boo. And in my case, I think people at least realize, even if they disagree with me, that I'm legitimately trying to do what's best for a lot of people out there. But I think you tapped into something. It is seen as being a red state thing, but I don't necessarily think that's the case.
For example, there was the WWE opened up a store.
Right. Yeah.
Times Square, it was right next door to the New York Times. I couldn't, we couldn't help.
Did you ever stop in for a Mick Foley action figure?
I did stop in. It scared me. But I was actually surprised when it went out of business. It only lasted a couple of years. And the reason that I was surprised is that there were always lines out the
door. Yeah. Well, for a few years, it was hot. I mean, and even the nightclub when they toned down the wrestling theme on weekends was a go-to place. I mean, Britney Spears did her album debut performance there at the World.
They call it the World.
Yeah, Derek Jeter had his birthday party there. I think,
I didn't remember if
it was just a matter of having an outlet store, I think they would have been fine. But Vince McMahon is the type of guy who doesn't want to do anything halfway. As a matter of fact, when I suggested, hey, why don't we have a wrestling political debate, and I suggested going around a couple college campuses. He heard that, and he didn't want to go around a couple college campuses. He said, we're doing it, and we're doing it at the University of Miami before the day before the real debate with President Bush and Senator Kerry. And that's what led to me.
You did JBL. JBL debating.
Yeah, I took the startling, progressive stance on national television. But I think part of it is that Vince chose to create the World in 30,000 square feet of the most expensive real estate in the world. And when the wrestling craze died down a little bit, it was just impossible to hold on to that. And I know, 9/11 is blamed for a lot of things, but I had been there when there'd be lines out the door. And when I showed up the day before Halloween to promote my Halloween book in 2001, I mean, it was like a bomb scare was there in the building. I think it chased away a lot of people.
That's probably true. But the other thing is about New York is that New York is so big that it can support. It can support tons of interest. I mean, it is certainly the case. There's probably three or four. The populations of three or four red states exist within the five boroughs.
Exactly.
Of New York. So the idea that Madison Square Garden is a big venue for wrestling isn't that surprising. But it does. You may have heard that. Madison Square Garden is also home to the Rangers and the Knicks.
Who? Bruce, we got to run. But listen, thank you very, very much for being with us. It's been a very informative time. And thanks for your article.
And I have to be honest, I got a confession to make here, Mark. I was never really angry. I was just playing that up for the benefit of ratings, proving once and again that talk radio is fake.
Again, Bruce, thanks a lot for being with us. Right now, it's time for the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Maren's not here, but Kent the Colonel Jones is.
Okay, write these down, everybody. One, if someone asks you who won at the NCAA tournament this weekend, say, I know who lost. The American people. Two, after this weekend's anti-war protests,
clear space in your garage to store those fake coffins. 3. Host an 8-hour wine tasting in Napa Valley, then hit everyone up for donations to MoveOn.org. 4. Help your child cheat during a Little League game, and then announce that from now on, he's playing by the Tom Delay rules. And 5. Today's phrase, just dropping into conversation. Oh, sure, Marin's on vacation. That's like saying Bush got reelected. Wake up, sheeple. They'll disappear you next.
Oh, God. Kent the Colonel, I don't know what you're doing, but you do it well. Mick Foley's been a real gas having you here with us. You're going to be back to do it all over again tomorrow morning.
It's been fun.
Have a nice day.
Enjoy yourselves. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.